from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with the Symphony's Simon Crookall about the upcoming onstage ball.
I'll talk with WFYI's own Jim Simmons about his Creative Renewal Fellowship.
And then I get to meet Yo-Yo King, Mitch Camisano.
And of course we'll have our Arts Calendar Week all.
What do we do? All this and more right after the latest news from NPR.
On stage is the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra's Elegant Ball presented by their Women's Committee. This year, the evening is all about children, showcasing the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra as well as the Symphony in Color winners, and all proceeds will be used to support music education through the Young People's Discovery Concerts. Travis DiNicola spoke with the ISO's president and CEO, Simon Crookall, about the ball and what else is going on at the ISO this summer.
Simon, welcome to Art of the Matter. It's great to have you in our studio today.
Thank you, Travis. It's good to be here.
You guys have a big summer planned. Lots of really exciting things going on at the Symphony and also, of course, at Connor Prairie. But the main thing I want to talk with you about today, Simon, is this new event that the Women's Committee is putting on called On Stage. It's sort of even though the Women's Committee certainly has done many events over the years, this one is a very unique one for you.
Yes, exactly. We're taking a leaf from the Vienna Philharmonic, actually, and the Vienna Opera Ball, where the theatre is transformed into a wonderful ballroom once a year. And the Hilbert Circle Theatre is also going to be transformed. And people will have the opportunity to dance on stage with the Indianapolis Symphony playing, which is a rare opportunity these mm-hmm. days. So it's going to be a very exciting event, and I think very popular.
So a very appropriate name, On Stage. Literally, yes. People will be coming in, if I understand right, actually through your Symphony Center entrance on Washington, and sort of going through a tour of kind of the backstage area, and then it leads them out onto the stage.
Exactly. It's an entrance that performers use, of course, for mm-hmm. decades, but the general public doesn't generally get to access the theatre that way. So there's a bit of a kind of surprise as you come through the backstage corridor and onto the stage. And we're building out the stage quite significantly, so there's plenty of room for a dance floor as well as the symphony.
Great. So everyone will be on stage at the same time.
That's yes, which would be great.
And you mentioned, you know, dancing, of course. I can't imagine that the symphony is often, you know, called in as a dance hall band.
So. Well, you know, the great thing about symphonies is that they're very flexible, very versatile. Mm-hmm. We play everything, as you know already, from the classic standard repertoire right through to jazz and Broadway and film music. People have danced to orchestras for years, and of course the heyday was the Viennese repertoire, waltzes and polkas of Strauss and his mm-hmm. Contemporaries. So we're going to do some of that, and people should already start to brush up on their waltz and polka technique so that they're ready for the occasion. But then we'll be doing some big band music.
It's a little swing, too. And
exactly.
So. Yeah, I'm wondering if right now the dance classes are filling up all over town.
You know, well, I certainly hope so.
People start to brushing exactly. up and getting ready. I mean, what a great experience to be able to, of course, ballroom dancing used to be, much more commonplace, and in some ways it's made a comeback over the past few years, but it's not often that you would get the opportunity to dance to live music, much less a world-class symphony.
Put on your dancing shoes and come out and join us. And of course, you know, with Dancing with the Stars and all of these mm-hmm. shows on TV, it's a much more popular activity right now.
Yeah.
So the Women's Committee have been ingenious in arranging events like this over the years. This Women's Committee in Indianapolis was once the biggest volunteer organization for any arts group in the country.
Well, I know they've been very active for years, and as you said, they're all volunteers.
Yes,
who
yes.
help to put on different events and participate in helping to just improve the symphony.
Yes, mm-hmm. Some of them are educational activities, like our wonderful Symphony in Color competition, the painting competition for school children. Some of them are fundraising activities. They work very hard through the year to raise significant sums of money for the symphony, and they're all very dedicated to the mission of the symphony, which is great.
And I know you mentioned Symphony in Color. This evening on stage is really a great showcase for what the symphony does in terms of music education. I know that the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra is going to be performing well.
Yes.
That's great. There's such a fantastic group of kids who are performers there.
Yes, one of the focuses of the Women's Committee fundraising these days is on the work we do with youth, and that spans a number of different programs in schools. The Metropolitan Youth Orchestra became part of the ISO last summer, and we're very excited about helping that to grow and strengthen. That has a wonderful mission, which is more related really to social development and cultural skills than simply learning how to play instruments, but of course music is a very important part of it too.
Absolutely. Yeah, those young musicians are going through just a great program where they really mature quite a bit, both as musicians and as people. You mentioned Symphony in Color. A number of the winners from that competition will be featured this year, I know, as part of it. That's a really neat program. I actually got to participate as a judge a couple years ago.
Oh, that's right.
In
yes.
that. And,
yeah.
You know, with schools all across the state getting copies of different musical pieces, and then the art teachers essentially asking their students to paint what they hear.
Yes. Yeah. Which is a great way of helping them to listen to music too.
Yeah, really.
In a different fashion.
That's such a great program. And then tell me about the Young People's Discovery Concerts, because I know that that's one of the programs that's going to benefit from the onstage ball.
Yes. Well, we've just finished another round of Discovery Concerts. We had just over 22,000 elementary school children down at the Hilbert Circle Theatre. Not all at once, thank goodness, but over 16 performances. And what happens is that the buses line up and drop them off at the front of the theatre. They come in and have an hour of music. There's always a theme and a meaning to the concerts. This year it was all about hopes and aspirations and dreams. And beforehand they are able to participate in workshops with their teachers come in for teacher training with our musicians and our education staff. They then get a full workbook and CD that they can take back to the classroom and prepare the children for the experience they're going to have. I always feel a little bit sorry for the teachers
That's
afterwards, because we hype up the kids like crazy and then they have to go back to the classroom. But it's a very exciting experience for the children to see a live symphony orchestra on stage, to come downtown.
Yeah.
And again, they come from about 50 different counties to participate in those concerts. So it's a very important part of our activities.
Do you feel like you're building future audiences with activities like this?
You know, it's very difficult to make that direct connection from education activities into audience. But what we do know is that they're very unlikely to participate in concerts and attend concerts unless they've had this kind of introduction at an early stage.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing it's fairly altruistic work, because we're introducing them to the symphony, we're introducing them to music, and of course research shows now that work in creative activities helps cognitive learning in other subjects. So that's part of it, but of course we're also hoping that we're creating the audience of tomorrow.
Of course.
And many people in the audience now tell me that their first experience with of a live symphony orchestra was hearing the orchestra in those days very often in the schools themselves, and Isla Solomon used to take the orchestra out to schools. Nowadays it's frankly much more efficient to bring the children into the theatre, and it gives them a great experience too.
Yeah. Well, and just being in the theater is a fantastic
yes.
space, and then hearing the symphony. Going back to on stage with the ball that's taking place again on June 19th, Friday night. Of course, there's a fantastic dinner as well, and cocktails and all of that, in addition to the dancing.
Yes, it'll be the usual format. Come in, have some cocktails on the stage, listen to the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra playing. Then we disperse for dinner. at different parts of the theatre in the front of house, and then come back again after dinner to dance to the orchestra.
So really utilising the entire space.
The full building, yes. Yeah. Well, it's a resource that we're very lucky to have, and
yes.
We should use it as much as possible.
Well, it sounds like just a great evening, and in many ways the timing, I think, is quite appropriate, because it sort of wraps up in some ways the end of the regular season and kicks off then Symphony on the Prairie, because
that's
that
right.
Starts up the next night.
Exactly,
I believe, yes.
We're out on the Prairie on the June 20th
mm-hmm.
For the first night of our 12-week season, which will this year be symphonic music from the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
How's that for a change?
This is a first-time thing as well, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very programmatic there. And this... this is part of that whole year-round resource of the orchestra that we,
mm-hmm.
we always talk about. The previous weekend, we finish up the classical season
mm-hmm.
With pictures and at an exhibition. Then we do on stage on the Friday, and on Saturday we're out at the Prairie, and then there until Labor Day, in fact. So,
and then you have a really varied season out at Symphony on the Prairie this year.
Yes.
Lots of different types of music, a lot of interesting guest artists. I want to go back for a moment to the Grateful Dead piece, though, because now, yeah, and I'm a huge fan of the Grateful Dead, but I'm trying to conceive of a symphonic take on what they do, especially, you know, with their long jams that they're known for. And
well,
that's probably not going to happen. I'm
you know, sometimes we do these shows with a kind of lookalike band, that, and the symphony is the backup for
uh-huh.
that band. So, for example, we're out at White River State Park with the music of Led Zeppelin this
mm-hmm.
year. That will be the Led Zeppelin band accompanied by the ISO with symphonic orchestrations,
okay.
arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with the Beatles. We've got a Beatles group out at the Prairie this summer. Grateful Dead is slightly different. It's symphonic arrangements of the music. So there won't be a Grateful Dead band on stage,
okay.
or a look-alike Grateful Dead band on stage, or listen-alike. But the symphony will be playing Grateful Dead tunes arranged symphonically. So it's a slightly different kind of idea. And we're hoping it's going to be very popular. It's already been taking place in different parts of the country to
okay.
great success. So yes, it's going to be intriguing. I'm
know sure
exactly how the audience is going to take it.
It could be a lot.
But
well,
we also
they have some. I mean, the Grateful Dead makes some beautiful music.
Oh, absolutely.
It'd be really yeah. interesting to introduce that music to some of your Symphony on the Prairie listeners.
Quite,
as well.
Quite.
Yeah.
And we've got this year out at the Prairie for the very first time. Extraordinarily, Mario Vanzago is going to be there conducting a program of classical favorites. Jack Everly's there with Michael Kavanagh singing the music of Billy Joel. We have a Mozart program.
Mm-hmm.
We have, of course, the 4th of July concerts, which are so very popular. And, you know, the first year I was here, somebody
mm-hmm.
asked me how we celebrate the 4th of July in England. And I said, it's not one of those festivals we really celebrate in the
yeah,
UK.
No.
Anyway,
yeah,
but
if
here,
you start
of course,
really thinking about the history there, I would not imagine it would be. But, you know, we appreciate that you choose to celebrate it here
oh,
with us.
I'm now, you know, yeah. of course. Very happy to celebrate with my fellow Americans.
Travis DiNicola with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra's President and CEO, Simon Krukel. The onstage ball takes place June 19th at the Hilbert Circle Theater. For more information, visit IndianapolisSymphony.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The name Jim Simmons sounds familiar. I'll bet that you watch our sister station, WFYI-TV, where Jim has been a producer for several years. Through a 2007 Creative Renewal Fellowship, Jim planned a 2-year adventure designed to get him out from behind a camera and out of the editing booth into a world he was unfamiliar with. Jim journeyed with the Mercy Foundation on a trip of medical and humanitarian aid to Nigeria, and he wrote a book capturing highlights of the trip. Sharon Gamble invited Jim to talk about his experience of renewal, and he began with a reading from his book, The String of Days, Random Thoughts About Saving the World. He's describing the scene in an operating room where he is assisting a surgeon.
It is dark outside now, and with the blackness have come fiercer, more intense storms. I know that I will never have another day like this in my life. It is not script-like or movie-like. I have often heard firefighters describe the carnage that was the 9/11 attacks as looking like a scene out of a movie. There are elements of drama here, but it is all very real. And in some mysterious way, it is perfect. The rhythmic flickering of the surgical light, brightening and dimming to the pulsing of the generator that powers it, is joined by an occasional brilliant flash of lightning and the cannon of thunder. A deafening downpour slams against the windows, drowning out the casual conversation of two nurses cleaning up and chatting in the corner of the operating theater. Their work done, ours still underway. There is a dreamlike quality to hearing the occasional lilt of their small talk laughter as we still work on the bodies cut open beneath us. A small group of patients huddles outside, silhouetted by a fire which, although protected from the downpour, can offer no warmth. Its fuel is the collection of cysts and tumors that we have removed from the good people of Yoromi, and it's best not to stand too close to the vapors. These are the ones that did not get into the clinic today. It is just past dark, and they are the beginning of the queue for tomorrow. Soon my work is done, and I begin to walk to the disrobing area. I turn my attention back inward to the operating room itself. She is very young and round-faced, the woman whose unconscious face I am looking at. Round eyes, round nose, a little chubby, benign. We removed a cyst just moments ago and stitched her up like a garment. The cyst sits in a small metal tray next to her. It is so large, looking like a gray baseball with a large painted-on red artery running alongside its edge. I see her through the huge glasses I am wearing. It was a matter of life and death not to get any blood from her splashed into the eyes while operating. She is, you see, HIV positive. And as I look at the sweet, calm woman silently lying there, naked, her arms flung out to each side like Jesus on the cross, I wonder what fate will befall her. I wonder if she will die terribly, without access to the drugs she needs just a few years from now. And I also know that I will never know. As I leave my day in surgery, I know one thing and fear another. One, I don't even know her name, or if she's married, or if she's somebody's mother, or if she's all alone. But two, I think in some ways it has been a very bad day at the office.
So, in your day-to-day life, you are in charge of taking elements of the world and packaging them in neat, tidy packages for television.
Mm-hmm.
What about your day-to-day life made you want to fling yourself across an ocean into Nigeria, into this situation? This operating room where you're assisting, handing instruments.
The reason I wanted to do that was because in making my packages, I had become an observer. And more and more I was an observer, and I wanted to be a participant. I often joke with people, for instance, like if I was filming and doing a documentary about you,
mm-hmm.
and you were to keel over right in front of me right now, I would have to call 911 and watch somebody else come in and save your life, and I wouldn't be able to do it because I would be taping them saving you.
Mm.
And I had gone on an overseas documentary trip about a year before and came back rather than being excited about it. And it was to Morocco, and it was really exciting. We worked in that, we did a documentary about a clinic. I came back really, really bummed out. I mean, that's the best way to describe it, because I felt like I wasn't doing anything. I felt I was spending all my time watching other people do things. And so I was getting more and more distant. You know, you talk about the art that I have of creating these packages. I was feeling more and more distant because I did that. I said, I'm not really making a difference. And so I decided that I would be the participant. And it was funny because when I went, my friends here at the station, they said, oh, take a camera along. And I said, no. And even recently I did a reading and somebody said, well, a documentary's next, isn't it? And I said, no, this one experience, this is strictly me, my eyes, my brain, my hands, and no technology. And the reason is I just wanted to be a participant. There's a follow-up to that real quick, and that's that it did actually work. The program is called Creative Renewal Fellowship, and I actually came back really more appreciative of what I did, what I do for a living. And the reason is I suddenly realized when I was over there, you know, that right now when you and I are talking, there's like a million people over in Africa right now helping, giving pills, doing surgeries, giving injections, immunizations, and you and I don't know about them. And they're doing it right now. We don't even know. Mm-hmm. So I came back saying, well, no, there is value in what I do in chronicling these things and getting them on the air. That's important because I'm telling somebody's story. I had just told other people's stories for too long, and I had to have a story of my own so that I could go back to telling other people's stories. It sounds kind of weird. But
it makes perfect sense.
So I, you know what's funny is, again, it's called Creative Renewal Fellowship. And it did exactly what it was designed to do, or maybe what I designed it to do, and that's it renewed my interest in what I do by doing something completely different.
Did it also make you realize that there's power in what you do to inspire other people to not just watch television, but to get on a plane with a program and go help deliver food, help organize the queue of people lining up to get prescriptions or whatever?
Yeah, I think it does, but I think what you have to be real careful about is the way television is now is everything's kind of formatted. If you channel flip on an afternoon on cable, you see a lot of shows, they all look alike. One of the big things you have to do, or what I have to do in my job, is if I'm going to do that, if I'm going to make people aware of what's going on, I have to try to find different ways to do it, even though it's all basically visual and editing and writing and stuff like that, because you can get lost in the shuffle. I mean, you turn on the TV late at night and you see all these, well, you see a lot of starving people and a lot of documentaries about raising money for things, and you have a tendency to go like, oh, well, okay, there's another one of those. So the thing you have to keep in mind when you do what I do is, okay, I want people to respond to this. I want them to be able to think that they can do it too and to know they can do it too, but I also want to tell it differently than everybody else is telling it. So I get
so
them.
So it stands out.
Yeah, so I draw them into the story. I don't want them to watch the first 30 seconds and go, oh, you know.
Another one of those.
Yeah, I've seen this.
Flip. Yeah.
So you have to be careful.
Speaking of format, you do, I do, both of us work for WFYI in radio and television, and these are media that are old enough that there are formulas, there are formats that generally you need to follow. You know, an Across Indiana story can't be too long or it's going to get whacked down to fit the format.
I wonder who does that.
A documentary about the Hope Givers or whatever documentary has to fit in, you know, give or take 28 minutes or whatever.
Yeah.
What was it like for you personally to not have a template to follow when you decided to write this book?
Was it
scary?
No.
Was it liberating?
It was, in the sense that I didn't see one of the things you do when you have that template to put it in. You're not really organizing so much as you are making those decisions. You know the old line: what to leave in, what to leave out. I didn't have to leave anything out. And one of the fun things about that was that if you know, in the book, there are scenes in there about stuff that would never be in a documentary, you know, personal things that happened or some of the little sidebar comments and sidebar adventures, relationships that formed, shopping things that we did that just, you know, for ourselves in the midst of all of this, just to blow off steam. And, you know, none of those would have made it into a show. There were also moments that I could remember, like in the sense that you take your camera almost everywhere, but not everywhere. And I think if I had been doing the documentary, the funeral procession through the rundown part of the city, that probably wouldn't have been caught on film. So actually, it was fun to do that because anything was fair game. for what you were observing. The other thing that was a big plus for it too is there's a story in there about my little Echo. It's the little girl that I was counting out numbers for people in line, and there was a little girl who would stand behind me, and she would shout out the numbers after I did, and then she started to have fun with me by shouting out different numbers or shouting out several numbers in a row, and then she would giggle and hide behind her friends. And I realized if I'd had a camera, that never would have happened.
It would have been intimidating.
Yeah.
For both of them.
Well, you know, what would have happened is it evolved over time. I mean, I was an authority figure. She didn't start right away.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of saw me, and then she, you know, thought she could do it, and then she said it, and then she kind of giggled, and then saw my reaction. If I had been shooting, I probably would have shot that and then gone on to the next thing, you know, to try to get as much as I could for the documentary on film. So that never would have happened. So there were a lot of good things.
Even though your trip is confined within really very few days, this gave you kind of a leisure to develop some relationships that you wouldn't have had if you'd been, you know, trying to stick to a script.
Oh, yeah. And even when you do a documentary and you interview people, they will mention stories to you. Like, oh, the Morocco documentary, this goes, oh, this little boy that came in the clinic, and she described in very elaborate detail this little boy that she had helped. I never saw that kid when we were taping because we were in a different part of the clinic. So what you realize is that everybody has a personal story. And you do your best that you can to get as many as you can, but you can't be everywhere. And so... And you still can't be everywhere when you're doing what I did with the book, but you can be one of those people that are in one place long enough that a special thing happens. And that seems like it happens all the time to people that goes on these trips, but is hit or miss if you're having to shoot a lot.
Sure.
Because you can't stay in any one place long enough.
And you were able, it's maybe only a few dozen of the 150 million people in Nigeria, but you were still able to get to know some children, some adults, some politicians.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
The book is very brave in revealing your feelings about what you're experiencing. Disappointments, worries about your own commitment to various things in your life and in this trip. Did you ever, in the process of writing, backspace, cut, paste, don't want to go there? Or were you able to steel yourself and just get it all out?
I did not backspace, and it's a funny reason why. I do the show Across Indiana, and going before I wrote this, we did a piece on a guy named Michael McCauley, who's just a brilliant writer. He lives in Chicago. He's a friend of the host of the show, Mike Atwoods. And he contracted AIDS and wanted to go around the world and see what people were doing to combat AIDS. So he wrote this incredible book, and I talked to him about how he wrote. Oh, it's called The After Death Room by Michael McCauley. And so we did this Across Indiana story. He lives in Chicago, of all places, but that's not too far from Indiana. So we go up there, and I ask him what he did, and he said, here's what you need to do. You need to pay attention to what you're thinking and feeling. So, for instance, he wouldn't write, like, here's my book. He wouldn't say, I reached for the book. He would say, you know, I felt my fingers grasp the slick cover of the book. It did not have much weight. You know, be very specific. So I got his book. At first, I thought about my own experiences, and I thought, oh, boy, I'm really shallow because this guy's really deep. But he was very confessional, and it worked. And I didn't think anything less of him or odd about him when I talked to him because I knew so much about him.
You respected that.
Yeah, and I thought, well, I really like this book that he wrote, so I'm just going to do it in my book. Because he had a great style and a great way of approaching writing, and I was just going to follow his, not only his guidance, but his track record in how to do this.
What's the biggest thing that changed for you based on this experience, this trip, and then the several months' experience of writing the book after the trip?
It's a funny thing. The biggest thing that changed for me is my belief in infrastructure and structure and rules. We've gone through a lot politically in this country about how much people should be told what they should do and how much we should have controls and rules. And I lived in a place for a short while in doing this book where there were no rules and where there was no infrastructure and where there was nothing. I mean, really. I mean, I tell people that I'm just like everybody else that's listening to this. I thought I knew what third world poverty was because I watched all those shows that I was talking about earlier. You have to see it in person to really get a sense of it. And that's what it's made me a believer in more structured partnerships. You have to have a goal and you have to have things as a society and you have to have things set up to be there. To get there. And, you know, you say that these days and people talk about socialism or totalitarian. It's not that. It's just you have to have a set of rules that we all play by. And then if you're going to get your goods from point A to point B, there has to be a road there or there has to be plumbing there. Or if you're going to have banks, you know, not everyone can be walking out the front door with a couple million stashed in their pockets. Because when we were in Yoromi, you know, the territorial governor was on the run because he'd absconded with millions of dollars and had left the country. You know, you've got to, you know, so now we've got Bernie Madoff, you know, in our country. But that's what I'm saying. You have to have structure. And it can be physical structure, law, legal structure, but that's what I came back as being a big believer in. And I know of all the things I saw about health and life and death, and all, to take that home. But I remember flying home, looking out the window as we flew over Indiana and saw all the nice laid out roads and you could see a school every so often and stuff like that. And I just remember the absolute chaos of some of these places that we had gone to. And you just knew that was the difference. You know, just you can't function when there's nothing.
Sharon Gamble with WFYI TV's own producer, Jim Simmons. Jim received a 2007 Creative Renewal Fellowship funded by the Lilly Endowment through the Arts Council of Indianapolis. If you're interested in reading Jim's book, The String of Days, Random Thoughts About Saving the World, go ahead and drop him an email at jsimmons, that's J-S-I-M-M-O-N-S, at WFYI.org.
Travis?
Yeah, sure.
Could you maybe come down off that ladder with your yo-yo?
Sharon, I'm practicing.
You're practicing the compulsory ladder trick.
Yes,
for the yo-yo event.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have some recording to do here. Come on down. Don't worry, you'll be able to go back to it later.
Okay.
It's time for that calendar thing we call
What Do We
Do?
And if you have no idea what we're talking about, then stay tuned for the interview that I'm
exactly
doing
right
after What Do We Do with a yo-yo king. But until then, I'm just going to keep on practicing. Sharon, what are you doing while I'm practicing my
yo-yo?
Well,
you know, Indianapolis audiences have a chance to hear a concert coming up pretty quickly now, Saturday, June 6th at 7:30 at the DeHaan Fine Arts Center. And the concert is part of a farewell tour by one of the highest profile chamber music ensembles ever in the history of the world. And if you have Guarneri String Quartet in your head, you're exactly right. They're coming here as part of their retirement tour, essentially. They've announced their retirement, and they will be performing as part of the Ensemble Music Society series. And Travis, you're gonna talk to John Faley from the Society very soon to find out more about this. But I just wanted to give people the heads up because the DeHaan Theater only holds about 500 people, and you probably should act quickly to score a ticket if you want to
go.
That.
But I'll be chatting with them next weekend about this.
Good.
Yeah. Hey, the Indiana Wind Symphony is celebrating not just 10 seasons, but 100 concerts. Over those 10 seasons,
wow.
And their 100th concert is taking place Saturday night, May 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Ben Davis High School Auditorium, and they're presenting Jackson Wiley the annual James B. Calvert Outstanding Music Educator Award as part of this, which is very, very cool. And so there will be tenor soloist Ken Knowles, and the IWS saxophone section is going to be doing some pieces, and all around a great concert, and even some selections from John Williams' Star Wars score. Again, this is the 100th concert of the Indiana Wind Symphony tonight, 7:30 at the Ben Davis High School. Tonight if it's Saturday, or tomorrow night if you're listening on Friday night.
There you go.
Well, Sharon, we will be back next week with lots, lots more on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Must go down, and up, and down again. This May 30th, the Idlejord Museum will host the Indiana State Yo-Yo Contest. This day will entail a gathering of 50-plus yo-yo competitors showcasing their talents in one or more of the five different class divisions. Representatives and experts from the NYYL, that's the National Yo-Yo League, will be on hand to answer questions and help participants perfect their tricks.
This is Travis DiNicola with Yo-Yo King, Takeshi Kamasato, and Pete Brown from the Idlejord Museum. Which yo-yo are you starting out with here?
The one I actually have is a metal yo-yo. It makes a really strange sound if you're not familiar with yo-yos. It's aluminum. It's an Italian-made yo-yo, and it's called an oxy. And then we have sort of the plastic Duncan. It's a freehand zero, one of the most popular yo-yos today. It has a slightly different sound.
Takeshi, tell me about the logo that's on that yo-yo.
This is actually one of my limited edition signature series freehand zeros. A limited quantity of 300 were made about 2 years ago.
Wow, very cool. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you got a third one there? Or?
Yeah, this is actually a Canadian yo-yo, another all-metal yo-yo with a little different sound. This is a Trainwreck, a signature series by my friend Tyler Severance, who actually won the World Yo-Yo Contest.
Wow. And the sound you hear is it sort of goes whir as you're flipping it around and doing different tricks with it. And the sound certainly changes. Could we hear that one more time?
Sure.
So this is the third year for the Indiana State Yo-Yo Competition that's going to be at the Idlejord.
That's correct.
Very cool stuff. You know, I've heard about this before, and I always thought, you know, it just sounds to me like an enormous amount of fun. I'm curious how it all ended up at the Idlejord and stuff, and we'll get to that in a minute. But let's just start with sort of a brief description of what this day involves. Takeshi?
Well, it starts off, it's, you know, a regular yo-yo competition, and it starts off with some of the basic yo-yoing contests that there are, which is called a sport ladder. And that involves a list of tricks, and competitors have the list, and then a judge sits in front of them, and they just go down the list at how many tricks they can do. And that's okay. More for beginners. It starts with, you know, like just simply throwing the yo-yo down and getting it back to your hand is the first trick.
Uh-huh. I was wondering, because I saw online on the website that there was the compulsory sport ladder. I'm thinking, okay, you know, I know a couple yo-yo tricks. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, like walking the dog and stuff and shoot the moon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was thinking, like, okay, is the ladder a trick? Or, okay, so it's actually, it's a ladder of tricks, essentially.
Yes.
That people have to sort of work through first. So, I'm sorry, go on. What, mm-hmm. Some of the other ones? That,
And then to move on to the more advanced divisions, we actually have five separate yo-yoing divisions in sort of the freestyle category.
Okay.
And yo-yoing has gotten so advanced over the past, really the past 10 years, that it's almost required these different divisions to be created. So we actually, it's created into 1A through 5A, and those styles range from doing single trick, like string tricks with one yo-yo, or looping tricks with two yo-yos, string tricks with two yo-yos, and then it goes on to actually an off-string division, which is the yo-yo actually isn't attached to the string at all, which is hard to describe, but it's exactly what it sounds like. You throw the yo-yo and it immediately comes off the string, and then you do tricks from there.
Really?
Yeah.
So you still, I'm trying to picture this. So the yo-yo is still, the string's wrapped around it, but not tied on it. And so you spin it off, and it's moving, and then you, what, sort of like catch it on a string? Or?
Correct. I mean, it's that's exactly what it is. It's almost unimaginable unless you see it. It's pretty hard to describe in words, but yeah, it is off the string.
And these are not our grandfather's yo-yos. I mean, I know you've got a Dunkin' shirt on, and you know I had Dunkin' yo-yos growing up. You know, of course the butterflies and stuff. But yo-yos have really advanced. You mentioned that competition for yo-yoing has really increased over the past 10 years. Part of that isn't the technology, the yo-yos themselves, or I mean, I see things like in toy stores, like you know, like more ball bearings or what have you. Or,
exactly. Yeah. It's it's sort of a give and take that the advancement of the styles and the type of yo-yoing that's evolved has come a little bit from the technology in yo-yoing, but also from, I mean, they play off each other. Sometimes the technology has to catch up with the players and vice versa.
Okay. Where do you think all this comes from? I mean, how did you get involved, for example? I mean, you're a champion, right? You've been doing this a while?
Mm-hmm. I really started throwing a yo-yo about 8 years ago.
Okay.
So,
so not when you were like just a young kid.
No, not at all.
I'm not saying you're an old guy. Just, you know, but.
Exactly. In the world of yo-yoing, I'm definitely not a spring chicken.
Okay.
But most of the champions and yo-yo players nowadays are in their mid-teens, early 20s, and I'm 33, so I'm kind of old to the game. But I don't know. I sort of just took to it, and it. You know, it clicked in my head. It was something I could understand, how to do the tricks and everything. And I got started. I really got started because I was going to school. Mm-hmm. I was going to Ivy Tech. And during the downtime, I wanted something to do, get my mind off of schoolwork, and it was the yo-yo. So from there, I got a job at the Children's Museum, and I began to demonstrate the yo-yo there. And that's where I really honed my skills. And then from there, I started going to competitions and getting noticed and getting sponsorships and things like that.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I mean, you know, and of course, I mean, yo-yos are great because you can take them with you everywhere. And, you know, when you have some downtime, as you mentioned, like at school or whatever, doing that. But the whole idea of, you know, like, yo-yo competitions, I'm sure, even though, you know, it's obviously part of your life, to be fair, it probably kind of sounds a bit foreign to people who aren't part of the yo-yo world. You know, when people meet you and they ask you what you're doing, like, oh, I'm a yo-yo champion. I mean, do you get some, you know, strange looks? Or
I do, and I actually try to avoid really telling them what I do if I don't have a yo-yo on me, because it is something that if you don't see, it's hard to believe what you can do with a yo-yo nowadays.
Yeah. Oh, and to be fair, I want to direct people to the video that you guys have done for the 2009 competition at the Idoljorg. I know it's on YouTube. If you just search through YouTube, or you can go to the Idoljorg's website, I think, and there's maybe a link there.
Yes.
It's really impressive to see. I mean, all these kids doing different tricks. I guess there's a lot of footage from last year. Is that right, Pete?
That's correct, yeah.
You're from the Idoljorg.
Yes, I'm a public programs manager there. And so I've been lucky enough to work with Takeshi and organize this event every year. But yeah, the video that's on YouTube, if people look for, they can search for ISYYC09, Indiana State Yo-Yo Contest 09 on YouTube, and they'll find what we've posted. But there's a lot of footage from the competition last year, as well as footage of Takeshi around the museum in the outdoor gardens. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we would have every style in that video represented in what people would see in the contest as far as the different divisions and even the sports ladder.
Definitely,
too, so.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
You know, one thing I noticed with the video was that there's some great music in there, and it goes pretty well with the yo-yoing. But I was wondering, in the competition, do people do it to music at all? I mean, it looks like it could be, you know, a choreographed piece.
Yeah. It definitely is. I mean, some Players have different styles and different ways to compete and get ready for it. Some players actually do coordinate a whole routine to a certain song. Other people go up there and do sort of a true freestyle and just whatever comes to their mind.
Okay.
So it's, there are all different ways to approach the freestyle, but you know, it all comes down to personal preference.
Sure. But people actually do work out routines and, mm-hmm. and things like that.
That was one thing that really struck me, actually, because when we first met, we were connected through a mutual friend and suggested that we work together because Takeshi is Native American. And so that was a great fit with the Idle Jorg's mission, of course, being a Western and American Indian museum. And so I knew nothing about yo-yos 3 years ago. You know, I was coming from the same background that you have explained. So it was great to see that it really is a large event. I mean, it's almost like it seems like a festival. People come from across the country to come and compete and come to meet up with their friends and come to learn and come to teach each other. It's a very gracious group, a very humble group of talented people. So we're able to offer things like beginner workshops where anybody can bring their kids, and someone like Takeshi or someone who's known around the world for having this talent will actually take time out of their day mm-hmm. and spend time with you or your children and get you going, you know. And we have some folks that come and sell products and things so they can buy these yo-yos.
Sure.
That yo-yos you couldn't even find in a store in the entire state. You know, these folks come out and share these things. So it really is a very unique event, and we're very thankful to be hosting it at the museum. So
that's very cool. I do have to ask, is there any other connection to, I mean, of course, the Idle Jorg is known as a great museum of Native American and Western art and culture. Any other connection with yo-yos and Native American culture at all? Or this is just a really cool thing for you guys to do?
Well, I'll let you answer that in a sec, but from my perspective, one thing that that I personally enjoy doing is kind of exposing the general public to portrayals of Native people that are not stereotypical or, you know, the average perception of what Native person should do, what a Native American should look like, what a Native American should, you know, be doing for fun. And I felt that this was a great tie because, you know, if you go to any fourth grade classroom and ask a student what does a Native American look like, what does a Native American do, they're not going to say yo-yo. They're just not. Yeah. And so by using that connection that we have there, it's able to expose hundreds of new people to not only the sport of yo-yoing, but also to a contemporary Native American person that's doing something that is so unique. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it's definitely allowed me to sort of get my background and my culture and sort of, educate people a little bit about my tribe and, you know, where my people come from. I'm actually half Japanese, half Native American. So I have this, you know, little cultural upbringing that I had was a little strange, and it's nice to be able to have an outlet to talk about that to people, so.
Very cool. Now, one thing, I'm sort of, this is totally a different side topic here, but I do want to ask you guys this. And I was Sharon Gamble, my co-host on Are the Matter, and I watched the video the other night online, and she said, "I'm not seeing any women there." And I started watching the video. I'm thinking, she's kind of right. I mean, it's a lot of, like, you know, young guys, some of them, you know, kind of hipster looking, some kind of, you know, dorky looking, some very cool looking, but it's basically all pretty much guys. Am I right with this?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there are, it is a male dominated sport, but there have been, you know, women world champions and so they're out there, but it's just, you know, a numbers game. A percentage is definitely.
This has been Travis DiNicola with Yo-Yo King Takeshi Kamisato and Pete Brown from the Idle Jorg Museum.
The Indiana State Yo-Yo Contest takes place on May 30th at the Idle Jorg Museum. You can find out more at idlejorg.org, and registration takes place from 9 to 11 a.m. at the Idle Jorg on May 30th.
Hi, this is Matthew Sosi. We're going to end this week's Art of the Matter with a tribute to Wayman Tisdale, who died last week at the age of 44. Tisdale was a basketball player, three-time All-American from the University of Oklahoma. He spent 12 seasons of pro ball with the Indiana Pacers, Sacramento Kings, and Phoenix Suns. After his athletic career, he had a second career as a musician. He was a jazz bassist and recorded 8 albums. Here's one of the songs from Wayman Tisdale called Throwing It Down.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 p.m. I'll chat with artist Mark Pack about his new exhibit.
I'll find out about the Beckett Project at Butler University.
And then I get to take a look at what the Ensemble Music Society is doing this summer. And, of course, we'll have our arts calendar that we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.